Welcome to Switchblade Sisters, where women get together to slice and dice our favorite action and genre films. I'm April Wolf, recording in my home office with probably a special guest appearance from my cat, Chicken. Every week, I invite a new female filmmaker on, a writer, director, actor, or producer, and we talk in depth about one of their fave genre films, perhaps one that has influenced their own work. Right about now is usually when I say the guest's name, but I have a little bit of bookkeeping to do before we get into the show itself. I just wanted to let all of you listeners know that we have decided to end Switchblade Sisters at the end of February. That is entirely my decision. It is based upon the fact that I am quite busy. And if you listen to the show, you know that Switchblade Sisters is a really well-researched and well-produced show that takes quite a bit of time to get to your ears. And it just wasn't becoming super sustainable for me and as my career moves forward. But I just want to thank every single one of our listeners over the years, every person who became a donating member, every person who told a friend to listen to us, who suggested a guest, and we finally got them on. I'm going to say more once we get to our final episodes, but just to let you know, I appreciate every single one of you. And if you're a member who supports other shows on Max Fun, you know the money that you put towards Switchblade Sisters will automatically be split up among those other shows after our show ends. If this is the only show that you support, however, just hang tight until March 1st. You'll get an email from the network about what to do next, and they'll just make it easy for you. Also, I would love to suggest, if you're in the mood for some movie stuff, you know, as Max Fun figures out their next step in programming, Who Shot Ya is great. If you're going to be sad and you want to try out another movie podcast on the network, this is the one to go for. My friends Drea, Iffy, and Alonzo host it, and I think you'll really love it. And also, I think it should be said that this show is one that is kind of what we would call in the journalism industry evergreen, meaning that it doesn't kind of matter when the episode came out. They're all worth listening to at any point in time. So definitely keep an eye out for those. If you've missed any episodes, you can go right back into the archive at MaximumFun.org. And you can always keep up with me if you like. I'm on Twitter at the moment. It's probably more than I would like to be a wolfful. And keep updated on some announcements that will be coming out too. But one last thing, one big thing. For our final show, we really want it to be just a blowout. And I would love for you to call in. We have a number set up, a Google Voice number, so you can call in and leave a message. And that number is 818-962-0286. And that is a chance for you to call in and tell us why you love the show, what it's meant to you, and maybe even just let us know what movie you would have picked if you were a guest on Switchblade Sisters. Again, that number is 818-962-0286. And just make sure that you call in by February 17th so producer Casey can include your lovely sentiments. Or if you just want to be mean, go for it too. I mean, it's whatever it is. And with that, let's go back to our show because we've got a great guest today. Today, I'm very excited to have writer-director Nora Unkle with me.
Hi.
Thanks. Am I saying your name right?
You are. Thank you.
Thank you. Nora, it's so lovely to see you amid the cold weather that we have recording today. You look bundled up and really, really warm, though.
Yeah, thank you. It sounds like we both have had some snow in our lives lately, so I'm really kind of trying to embrace the winter that has come upon us.
Yeah, some bi-coastal love here. So, Nora, I would love to introduce people to who you are and what you do. Nora is a writer, director, and post-production supervisor. She is a graduate of NYU Tisch School of the Arts, where she earned a degree in film and television production with minors in music and history. As a post-production supervisor, Nora has worked on several Sundance documentaries, including Wiener and Newtown. She is a co-founder of Wild Obscura Films, a production company focused on content for women, by women, and about women. Wild Obscura has been awarded gold at the Student Academy Awards with their short experimental film, Opera of Cruelty, and participated in the French Connection film market in Paris with IFP. Wild Obscura also served fellowships at the Made in New York Media Center in association with IFP at IFP's Film Narrative Lab with A Nightmare Wakes, which is now Nora's debut feature as writer and director. The film has had an arduous journey, first being among the top 2% of entrants for the Academy's Nickel Screenwriting Fellowship Program, then one of Slated.com's top 10 scripts of 2016. It was pitched at IFP Week 2017, the Frontiers Film Market in Montreal and Cannes, as well as the MOME Financing Lab, and now A Nightmare Wakes, which tells the story of the genesis of Mary Shelley's iconic novel Frankenstein, is premiering on Shudder. So you've been busy. This has taken kind of like a long journey, a lot of development. I'm sure that you're gonna have a lot of interesting stories to tell about how to get a movie made. But Nora, the movie that you chose to talk about today is a classic. It is Bride of Frankenstein. Can you give us a little explanation on why this is one of your fave genre films?
Oh, absolutely. Well, first and foremost, I am a huge fan of all the original Universal Monster movies. You know, growing up, my horror films were those films as well as Hitchcock. So that was kind of my foray into horror before kind of becoming a horror filmmaker. So for me, what I loved about this film was it was kind of the first interpretation that included some of the female characters from the novel and really got to kind of bring the story back into Mary Shelley's own hands in its own unique way. And I think it does a great job of portraying some of the actual themes of the novel that some of the other Frankenstein versions kind of avoid or miss.
Yeah, there's, I mean, we'll definitely talk about that, of just kind of like bringing it back to Mary Shelley's vision of this monster. But for those of you who haven't seen Bride of Frankenstein, today's episode will give you some spoilers. But, you know, as always, that shouldn't stop you from listening before you watch. My motto is that it's not what happens, but how it happens that makes a movie worth watching. Still, if you would like to pause and watch Bride of Frankenstein, this is your shot. And now that you're back, let me introduce Bride of Frankenstein with a quick synopsis. Written by William Hurlbut and directed by James Whale for release in 1935, Bride of Frankenstein opens with Percy Bysshe Shelley and Lord Byron praising Mary Shelley for her horrifying novel Frankenstein. And she tells them, oh no no, the story is not quite over.
That wasn't the end at all. Would you like to hear what happened after that? I feel like telling it. It's a perfect night for mystery and horror. The air itself is filled with monsters.
So we are transported back to the original Frankenstein movie. In the end, the villagers cheer the fiery death of the monster, but the man whose daughter was killed wants to see his bones.
Oh, Hans, he must be dead. And dead or alive, nothing can bring our little Maria back to us.
I can see his blackened bones. I can sleep at night.
Well, the monster did survive, and he's pretty pissed. So he kills both the man and his wife, and then stumbles through the woods. Henry Frankenstein's body, meanwhile, is hauled back to his waiting bride-to-be, Elizabeth. But he's not actually dead. Unfortunately, even though Henry's health is improving, Elizabeth knows his work is not done.
And when you raved of your insane desire to create living men from the dust of the dead, a strange apparition has seemed to appear in the room. It comes, a figure like death, and each time it comes more clearly, nearer. It seems to be reaching out for you, as if it would take you away from me.
Then, Dr. Pretorius arrives. One of the best characters. He comes along and shows Henry all the cool homunculi he made, all of which he keeps in little glass jars like dolls. Pretorius thinks all the monster needs is a mate. Everything will be fine after that.
Now, together, we will create his mate.
You mean, yes, a woman. That should be really interesting.
And meanwhile, the monster is spotted by a young shepherd girl who screams her head off and gathers a mob that catches the monster. But the second the monster is alone, he breaks his chains and escapes, where he finds a lonely, blind hermit who shares a meal with the monster and then teaches him to speak.
Remember, this is bread. Bread.
Bread.
It's a sensitive and fleeting friendship interrupted by the bloodthirsty hunters who provoke the monster, leading him to burn down the hermit's home. The monster hides in a crypt and then spies Pretorius and his dudes breaking into graves to steal some bodies. Pretorius then explains to the monster that he wants to give him a bride.
Make man like me?
No. Woman. Friend for you.
Woman. Friend. Yes.
The monster is certainly intrigued. Pretorius brings the monster to Henry's house, interrupting the guy's wedding night to blackmail him into participating in raising a mate from the dead.
I thought we might need another assistant. Perhaps he can persuade you.
Nothing can persuade me.
We shall see.
When he refuses, the monster is instructed to kidnap Elizabeth and bring her to Pretorius's lab. So Henry helps create the mate and finds he's actually pretty excited by it. Damn it, maybe this is what he was meant to do. Just like the monster, they bring the mate to life with lightning. She's unwrapped and unsettlingly striking. The monster attempts to touch her hand and she screams and hisses.
She hates me. Like others.
The monster freaks out because she too rejects him. He will never know a normal life. He tells Henry and Elizabeth to leave.
Yes, go. You live.
And then he pulls a lever that explodes the whole laboratory, taking Pretorius and his mate to their doom. It's a sad ending.
It really is.
Sad ending. I want to talk about the idea that James Whale, and we'll talk a little bit about this further too. James Whale had directed the original, was not necessarily keen on directing another one, because sequels are kind of hard and you're also kind of bound by the story that you already told before. But, you know, he did come back. And I want to talk about finding ways to invigorate a story either you've already told or someone else has already told. The quotes that I'll be saying are from the Blu-ray. There's multiple voices saying this. Sometimes it's Joe Dante, sometimes it's some historians, but I kind of mix these together. So, this quote, the original Frankenstein was a huge hit. The Universal studio head Carl Laemmle Jr. wanted to start production on the sequel immediately. It didn't start, though, for several reasons. There were problems developing the script, Boris Karloff was busy with other movies, and James Whale wasn't much interested in making the movie. Whale, however, got more excited about the project when he was given complete creative control. A new character is on hand to shake up the story, Dr. Frankenstein's professor, and he has his own ideas about creating life. He sells the monster on the idea of a bride, end quote. It is a genius stroke, I think, to have this movie follow up the last one, because it is fun. It is strange and it is emotional. It has a kind of almost three-dimensionality that I wouldn't say isn't necessarily in the first one, but it feels like it's so many more things in The Bride of Frankenstein.
Oh, absolutely. I feel like it kind of digs into a lot of the themes that it sets up in the first movie. And, you know, in a fun way, it really is the second half of the novel, Frankenstein. And so he does this beautiful job of kind of bringing us back into that world while holding on to or kind of bringing to light a few more of the actual kind of deeper themes and deeper tones from the original story.
I think the thing that I love, though, is that he's not afraid to bring a new character in. He's not afraid to add a different kind of dialogue or language to them, because the way that Pretorius speaks, the way that his presence in the movie is very different. There's also, I apologize, I can't remember the woman's name, but the kind of like, oh no, governor, like
Minnie,
she's
right?
Just like, yeah, Minnie, you know, just having these kind of character actors come in and reinvigorate what was something that could have been very staid and boring.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think with Dr. Pretorius, like, he brings in some of the elements of Victor, which is, another iteration of Henry Frankenstein from the novel, right, is named Victor. And so I think some of the kind of darker, more seedier aspects of Victor, the original kind of mad scientist, is brought in to Dr. Pretorius in a really fun, comical, over-the-top way. And I think I read somewhere that they were saying that it was also the director Whale was outwardly gay. And that this was a character that he was actually purposefully portraying as a little bit more homosexual, which was kind of really different for 1935. And so again, to be able to portray this more lively character, a different type of character than is normally expressed in films like this. Yeah, I think it was exactly what was needed for this type of story to expand and deepen it, while still actually going back to the original source material far more than I'd say even the original did.
I mean, is that something like in terms of, you know, your film, you are telling a story about Mary Shelley developing Frankenstein, and it's been told a couple of times in film, but is it going back to a source material that gives you inspiration to tell something differently? Or, you know, like how would you explain that?
In watching Bride of Frankenstein, actually, I was really inspired by this opening sequence that brought the story back into Mary's own words, into Mary's own life. And that got me thinking about, you know, what was surrounding her life when she was writing this story? What was influencing her in creating something that was completely unthought of before she wrote it down? And so for me, the original inspiration was going back to the book, and everything was about the book, you know. And I think a lot of these different iterations of Frankenstein, unlike, say, I think Kenneth Branagh's Mary Shelley's Frankenstein is probably one of the few that really kind of tries to encapsulate the actual novel. Because with these universal monster films, they came in and completely went a completely different direction, right? They
oh, yeah.
just made a whole new world for it, a whole new tone. The very fact that the monster is not eloquent, isn't able to speak, is a completely large veer from the original story. And so what I wanted to do was kind of take some of the pieces that were being put down in particularly Bride of Frankenstein and go back to the novel, go back to Mary's life, and almost do a visual book report of how Mary's life combined with the story and how each affected the other.
I want to talk about the idea that you kind of forget what's quote unquote hot in Hollywood, the things that other people are making. And sometimes you just do what you want to do. Because at the time that this was coming out, at least like the first Frankenstein, you know, like monster movies weren't like the big kind of like box office money made. Like it didn't really exist in that way. They kind of like made this niche. And, you know, then the box office makes it a big deal and all of a sudden it's there. But part of what they were doing with Bride of Frankenstein had to do with James Whale's dialogue. He was very famous for his plays in England. He came to Hollywood and because he had a really, really great knack for directing dialogue. And as the Blu-ray said, quote, ironically, just as Hollywood was beginning to talk, it was the unforgettable silent performances that made the career of Boris Karloff. Universal objected when Carl Laemmle's son first suggested making horror movies, but the box office speaks, end quote. And I think that that's a really interesting thing to think about of like Bride of Frankenstein was born out of something that, you know, wasn't hot before. And then all of a sudden he's like James Whale's making a movie within a kind of like hot horror environment. People are like, oh, kind of like going to get new horror movies. And how much of that do you have to kind of forget, you know, like what the market is?
Oh gosh. Personally, I had to completely ignore that. I think because of the anniversary, you know, Mary's death is, I believe it's 170th anniversary is coming up next week. And around the time when I was writing this was about the 200-year centennial for the novel being published. And apparently everybody else in the world also wanted to tell a story about Mary Shelley. And I mean, listen, I'm all for it because Mary should be getting as much, you know, recognition as possible for her work. And I think there's been many, many decades of kind of forgetting her and the context of her within her story. So for me, it was very much a, okay, I see other people are doing this. I see what's hot right now and I see what's in the zeitgeist. But at the end of the day, I know that this story is really unique and it's a very completely different take on how, because a lot of these films are biopics or they're Frankenstein adaptations. And I wanted to tell a story that was both. And that's hard to convince people of when you have, you know, lots of other iterations of a similar story or a similar timeline coming out. So I think for them, they got really lucky in a wonderful way that they really kind of kickstarted this whole movement of horror into Hollywood that we're now reaping the benefits of today as horror makers. But as far as your financiers allow you to ignore what's actually important in the industry,
I know, right?
I at least have really kind of said, great, let's ignore it and see what we can make.
I think it's like when I think about when the original Frankenstein film came out and there was a kind of push to do much more talking in films. And then you have one of your central character, like, not talking. I think it's just like, it's a choice. To then kind of gradually get the character to start talking in the second movie after it was so successful with a silent performance. It's a lot. And one of the things that I think is really interesting is the fact that audiences wanted to embrace both versions. They didn't, you know, like there wasn't a kind of like a rejection. You know, nobody rejected the monster.
Just everybody in the actual stories, unfortunately. I just always want to give them a hug, you know.
I know, it's so sad. But that's a credit to Boris Karloff.
It really is.
That motherfucker is so good.
He's so good. And it just like, for me, the scene with the hermit in this movie, it gets me in the feels every time. Even the mock version of it in Young Frankenstein, it gets my heart because this poor creature just wants love, just wants acceptance.
Oh. Well, I'm going to stop you there because we're going to visit that in just a second. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back to talk a lot more about The Bride of Frankenstein. We'll be right back.
Hey there, beautiful people. Did you hear that good, good news?
Something about the baby Jesus?
He's coming back.
Or do you mean the fact that Apple Podcasts has named Fanti one of the best shows of 2020?
I mean, we already knew that we was hot stuff, but a little external validation never hurts, okay?
Hosted by me, writer and journalist Jared Hill.
And me, the ebony enchantress myself, Javel Anderson.
Fanti is your home for complex conversations about the gray areas in our lives, the people, places, and things we're huge fans of, but got some anti-feelings toward.
You name it, we Fanti. Nobody's off limits.
Check us out every Thursday on MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your slayworthy audio.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Nora Uncle, and we're talking about The Bride of Frankenstein. Boris Karloff, we mentioned, he's just fucking amazing. I do want to talk about the fact that he actually did not want the monster to talk in Bride of Frankenstein, which I think is a really interesting thing. His daughter had some things to say about it. But the quote is, unlike the original film, Shelley's novel featured a highly philosophical monster. Whale restored the monster's ability to speak. Speech was the essential difference between the original and Bride. And his daughter said, quote, my father really objected to the monster being given speech. He felt it would take away from the original portrayal. And I think he was wrong. History has proven him wrong. It's one of the few film sequels that critics regard as surpassing the original. End quote. And, you know, sometimes you are wrong. Sometimes you have to trust your director. And it's actually like a pretty big credit to Boris Karloff that he did trust James Whale with him after the first movie to not lead him astray and to not kind of cheapen the movie in a way to make it a talkie. That's just like talkie. I would love to talk a little bit more about kind of making changes on set, being the person that your actors have to trust.
Oh yes. firstly, I will say that I completely agree with Boris Karloff's daughter in that I think that was one of the smartest decisions that they could have possibly made, which was bringing speaking back into this novel, into this film, just like the novel. Mm-hmm. But in terms of working on set, you know, I think, especially as a first-time director in a feature capacity and as a female director, it's a lot of trying to keep the respect and faith of your cast and crew going as long as you possibly can on set. You know, it's really about proving that, yes, maybe what I'm saying right now doesn't make any sense, but it's going to work in the end. And not just relying on saying things like that, but actually earning that trust and earning that acceptance that, yes, maybe this doesn't fully fit with what you're seeing in this moment, but as a director, as the writer, I'm having to see a much, much bigger picture in which I need to piece everything together. So it's part of the time it's kind of convincing, but most of the time it's about finding common ground and finding a collaboration. I was really lucky to have just the most exceptional department heads and cast around me. So most of the time it was less of a kind of an argument of like, this is what I want and this is what you want. And it was more of like, hey, this is what I want. And they'd go, oh, cool. Okay. How about if we do it like this with a fun twist? Yeah. And it's, you're a captain of the ship, but I find that collaboration is the way that you kind of keep it moving forward.
I am curious, you know, you mentioned that your film has, you know, quite a few dark scenes, but I also feel like there's something that maybe James Whale understood too. Is just like, sometimes you just need like one little gremlin, like one little like thing that kind of like pops up every once, or a character, for instance. And that's one of the reasons why he had kind of created Dr. Pretorius as this kind of like amazing queen who loves drama. And so there's a quote: after a brief glimpse of the monster in the beginning of the movie, the monster doesn't show up until the third of the way into the movie. And meanwhile, you spent all your time with this very strange character, Dr. Pretorius. If you look at him, that's how the movie has changed so radically from the first one. The first one is this boring doctor, and now there's this full-blown eccentric and very funny character who's developed by Whale, end quote. And, you know, I think about that in terms of like, there's a lot of things that are kind of dark and emotional in this, you know, the fact that like there's this monster who continually gets rejected every, like, it's just sad. It's pretty sad.
So
you know,
sad.
Like, especially like the dissolution of the friendship with the hermit, where you're like, oh, maybe everything can be okay. And you're like, nope, it's not.
Just
and then,
taken.
But then you cut. Yeah. And then you cut back to Dr. Pretorius just like having a lunch in the crypt. And you're like, yes, thank you.
Oh, my gosh. Just chilling, having a little picnic.
Do you ever feel like when you're writing things, do you ever put gremlins in just to kind of complicate things?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Plus, they're fun, you know. For me, with Nightmare, it was a little bit more, I guess, serious in tone to kind of, but I think I have a ghost-like figure that kind of shows up throughout, that's very much the gremlin, very much the like luring Mary into the darkness, into the evil gothic world that she's creating. And but I think in terms of these two, you know, Dr. Pretorius and Minnie, I've yet to be able to do anything remotely close to justice with something like that, which are both amusing and also very of their world. But I plan to with many more projects.
It's hard to convince people that that's okay to like to play with tone in that way.
Absolutely.
If you're doing something serious.
Especially nowadays where it's kind of assumed that it's like there's one tone, there's only one version. And I think that's actually something we're seeing with A Nightmare Wakes, is people are kind of going in expecting maybe a universal monster movie or a very classic straight horror film, and not necessarily expecting a different tone, which is more the tone of the novel. And so it's trying to adjust expectations that, you know, you can have different types of tones within a film. You can have something that's not necessarily cookie cutter horror or cookie cutter comedy, but you can have, I think the mix is what's fun.
Yeah, which is the pains that I'm sure James Whale went to when he was trying to tell people, like, no, no, he's got these homunculi in this glass jars. And you're like, okay.
It's going to be great. It's going to be great, I swear.
And I wanted to read this quote about the score, too, because I just love the score. And I know that I feel like you probably spent quite a bit of time working on the score for Nightmare. So this quote says, "The crowning touch was the inspired musical score by Franz Waxman, one of the most important Hollywood scores of the 30s. Waxman wrote a very charming period-style minuet, and as the flashback story is told by Byron, he evolves to a fugue before returning back to the minuet. And there was an awful lot of commentary through the music, sometimes impish, but like so much that is in this film, heightened. The basic structure is Wagnerian. He's using motifs for all the major characters or sequences, thematic building blocks that introduce a presence or imply their presence off camera. The monster has a four-note motif, which seems to be patterned upon his brow. We'd almost see that Waxman had seen this in the performance and incorporated it. The Bride has a very high three-note medley, however, very open-ended, and we first hear it when Pretorius speaks of her imminent birth. The Doctor has his own very mad loping thing. It pretends all sorts of things to come, but again, open-ended and unresolved. You never know where his actions will leave, end quote. I just think it's a really lovely analysis of what's happening there, because, you know, if you really take a step back, you're like, yes, there's this kind of high-pitched thing that's happening with the Bride, whether it's through her hiss, you know, or her shriek, or through the actual music that's introducing her. And, you know, there's the playful thing for the Mad Doctor. I just find it really fascinating, you know, like if we can pull those things apart.
Oh, yeah. And I love that the quote says Wagnerian, because that's absolutely exactly how I always interpreted it. And I always find any of these scores that really take advantage of key motifs and using these little subconscious signals to your audience of how to feel or what's to come. There's a lot of, like you were just reading, there's kind of allusions to what will be happening by the end, you know, that I absolutely love. And my composer for A Nightmare Wakes, we just Wagner geek over every,
oh, really?
Oh my gosh, that is what we do. we're huge Wagner fans. And so it was very much for us about, okay, what is Mary's theme? And oftentimes it was, what's Mary's instrument, you know, or what are these key motifs? What are these melodies that, you know, we have a love melody for Mary and Percy. We have Mary's abandonment, which eventually becomes her main theme. You know, these different things that ideally you might not notice right off the bat as, okay, this is telling me something, but you feel it. And you experience it, whether you can put words to it or not. And I think that's what's so beautiful, and the power of both sound and music is that it's this wonderful, like, direct in that a director has to an audience's subconscious and to the actual, like, feelings. Whereas, like, the visuals can very much be kind of like, okay, this is, you know, the first page of what you should be experiencing, but the depth of it is really coming in often with the sound and the music. I think that's one of the most effective elements of Bride of Frankenstein. And it's what makes you be able to go between, again, these kind of a little bit comedic and ridiculous scenes into scenes that are really heartfelt and really deep and really kind of wordlessly connect to this incredibly dark and deep character of the creature, even though we don't get to actually hear him talk about it much.
Yeah. What's Mary's instrument in your themes?
The oboe.
The oboe.
The oboe. Yeah.
Lovely.
Yeah. It's one of my favorite instruments, and I think it just has this incredibly melancholic yet clear tone, which for Mary it felt very apropos. You know, she's a very distinct voice, a very distinct personality, and yet, you know, is always going to be the solo instrument. But at the same time, there's this haunting sadness to the woodwind, unlike many others.
We're going to take a quick break again. We'll be right back to talk a lot more about the Bride of Frankenstein. We'll be right back.
I'm Jesse Thorne. On the next Bullseye, we've got the one and only Ted Danson. We'll talk about his new show, Mr. Mayor, about Cheers, and about the secret to success in comedy.
I mean, I feel like one of your signature comedic moves at this point in your career is gazing. You do a lot of interesting gazing.
I also love this. Gazing. I love that. And if I'm not, I'm going to start, because that's great.
That's Bullseye. Find it on MaximumFun.org, NPR.org, and wherever you get podcasts.
Welcome back to Switchblade Sisters. I'm April Wolf, and I'm joined today by Nora Uncle, and we're talking about The Bride of Frankenstein. So I wanted to make sure that I got some Clive Barker quotes in here, because I just love when he shows up in the commentary for this movie. And I just wanted like a whole thing of him talking about it. But he says, quote, "Pretorius is an archetypal queen, and I think we should fess up about that right from the beginning. He's the one seducing Frankenstein from the straight and narrow back into this more twisted vision of what he should be doing with his life. The gay sensibility responds well to outsiders, and Pretorius is an outsider. Frankenstein becomes an outsider after being seduced away from marriage and home, and most traumatically, the monster is the outsider," end quote. I think that, you know, I was kind of shocked to find that so much scholarship on this forgets the fact that so many people involved were gay. Whereas in the movie Gods and Monsters, you know, that kind of depicts the making of this film. It's definitely out there. But in terms of like the kind of like serious, quote unquote, serious scholarship about it, it feels like it's kind of an afterthought, which is one of the reasons why I was so happy that Clive Barker was included and was the one to be like, we should actually say this first.
Oh, it's so nice to hear just, you know, the honesty there.
It really is. But that's something that, you know, in terms of what lives on about a film or about a creative process, you know, we kind of whitewash certain things. Mm-hmm. We try to make them kind of straight and narrow, but literally and figuratively. But I think that that's one of the things that fascinates us so much when we find out these stories about Mary Shelley and the making of this book, is just that things were pretty fucking out there for her, you know?
Yes, they fucking were.
Like, that's not what you're going to learn about in your, like, high school English class when you read this book, if you are assigned to read it. You will learn it later on and be like, oh, shit, this is a drug-fueled haze of, like, loss and grief and all these other things. Like, stuff that you could feel but isn't necessarily, like, out there in the history books.
Yeah. Yeah, it's, you know, you don't really hear about the opium, about the fact that, you know, Lord Byron was bisexual and sleeping with literally anything that moved. You know, you're not thinking, you're not being told about the fact that this group lived in a society that believed in free love, which in all intents and purposes, they were kind of swingers. You know, it was, you don't learn about that. Often you don't even learn the fact that Mary was 19 when she wrote this, that she had run away with a married man across Europe to then get inspired and write with all of his famous friends while they're taking opium and drinking constantly and trading partners every couple of nights. Yeah, it's not really what you learn about, but I think it makes a lot of sense knowing that background and understanding that, yeah, this is a novel about outsiders, about people who don't fit with society, who, you know, aren't accepted by society. And so it makes a lot of sense that it was the outsiders, you know, who were inspiring her, and Mary herself being both an outsider as being a part of this group, but also an outsider within the group by being an intelligent woman amidst this sea of incredibly intelligent and well-educated men.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sometimes it feels like we, like, gentrified the story of Frankenstein or its creation. Like, whatever. But I wanted to get into the way, you know, we were talking about earlier about how Whale had so much control over, like, the story and the actors, but I wanted to get a little bit more granular on that. There was a quote that said, "Expressionistic tricks, totally artificial lightning." Oh, sorry, let me say it one more time. "Expressionistic tricks, totally artificial lighting and painted scapes. One of the things that intrigued me is the backgrounds that he had as a theater actor and director and set designer. And one wonders to what extent he would have had input into the visual appearance of his sets, to the extent that most directors would not be able to. When Elsa wasn't needed on set, she said he'd take her to the studio and show off the forest set. He would make little sketches and give them to the department heads and have them develop it," end quote. So he was like, you know, much more into, like, fingers on every single aspect, like, from the genesis. Of course, he would kind of let his technicians and his artists and craftspeople go about and make their things. But, you know, he was certainly sketching things. He was certainly overseeing every aspect. He was, like, very, very, very proud of the sets that he had constructed.
Oh, and you can feel that. There's such this cohesion, right, between all of the different elements of the film. I think that's one of the elements that is the glue that keeps everything together. The idea that he can see this entire picture before it is completed is what makes these sets not feel like a set. You know, he brings all of this detail work into every single aspect, you know, the set.
Yeah, the forest is amazing. Yeah. Like, and the forest set is different from the one that they used in the original. So they're like constructing multiple different forest sets for like different moods and like different tones. And it's just, I mean, like that is stagecraft, like to its greatest degree.
Absolutely. To the point that I didn't even know for many years until knowing how big cameras were at that time. I didn't know that those were shot indoors. You know?
Yeah.
And it reminds me a little bit of actually kind of the Lord of the Rings and their reconstruction of the Forest of Fangorn and how it's such a mood in and of itself. Like you were saying, the kind of the different types of forests that they had and, you know, the castle itself is such a unique castle. And you think that it's overdone because it's been redone so many times since. Mm-hmm. But, you know, him coming up with this entire look, this idea, that's completely fresh, right? Like, none of that is from the novel. In the novel, you know, Victor creates the monster in his dorm room. There's no castle, there's no electricity. But, you know, Whale really kind of brings all of that together and makes us really believe that this is the core of what this original story always has been, to the point where I think the last 100 years of audiences really think that, like, this is what Frankenstein looks like. This is what the world of Frankenstein looks like. And that's because he had just such a cohesive vision.
Yeah, you know, and also I just think in terms of, you know, the things that they are able to accomplish with lighting. And I'll say something too. John Mescal, who's the cinematographer on this, I just want to say this quick quote. John Mescal did a total 5 pictures with James Whale. It's the high mark of Whale's late period Universal. Mescal used a type of lighting he called Rembrandt lighting then, which was to use a central light and a cross light about 3/4 through the scene to provide illumination of the subject against a dark background light. Light that's directional and gives contours and definition, end quote. And there's something, you know, we were talking about control, indoor sets, the sets that they got to build. Like, you get to create your own reality. We talked a lot about this on our episode of The Company of Wolves and, you know, what it's like to kind of build your own world entirely encompassed in, like, a studio. But this is, you know, they're taking advantage of every little bit of control that they have in terms of lighting and design here. But, you know, when you're an indie filmmaker, like, the sets that you're shooting on, like, you probably need to find, like, an old historical house somewhere, you know, that, like, is going to have the rooms that are just the rooms that are there. And that's what you have to figure out, you know?
Yeah, building was not really a possibility for us. absolutely. But I think, actually, I did go back and look at Bride as an example of this, because they do have certain locations, I believe, that were, like, a French chateau, which has those incredible ceilings that create these epic looking shadows across the walls that are so beautiful. And I remember seeing that and being like, okay, we need to find our own. We need to find our house that has a unique, specific look, but that is of the period because we can't build it, that has maybe some of the furniture already there because we can't buy it. and we were so incredibly lucky to find this incredible place called Hyde Hall up in upstate New York. And they just happened to have every room already designed, set up for the literal year that we were aiming for 1816. It just, that's what they already had it all set up for. There was a portrait of Lord Byron in one of the studies. You know? It was just one of these where we walked in, we're like, oh my God, this is fucking meant to be. This is ideal. So I think location wise, I was so lucky that I didn't have to go and find a way of painting this new world. We just walked onto the floors of Hyde Hall and we're like, oh, we're transported to, you know, 1816 Geneva. here we are.
Like, wow, thank God. Okay, I guess we can make the movie now.
Seriously.
Thank you so much for coming in to talk about Bride of Frankenstein. And again, people can see your movie on Shudder. Can you tell us when?
Yeah, it's coming out on February 4th, about a couple days after Mary Shelley's 170th anniversary of her death.
Wonderful. And it's called A Nightmare Wakes. Anything else you want to tell us, how we can find you or anything?
I'm on Instagram at Nora Uncle, if you want to say hi. And otherwise, I'm on Twitter, same handle. But just thank you so much for having me. And thank you for anybody and everybody who checks out the film. We're just so delighted to finally be able to show it to the world.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, April.
Thank you for listening to Switchblade Sisters. Like I said at the top of the show, if you'd like to call in and leave us a message telling us maybe what movie you would have chosen if you came on the show, or maybe just what the show has meant to you, absolutely call in and leave a message at 818-962-0286. Anytime before February 17th, and even on February 17th, but you're cutting it close, but we'll leave it open for you. Our finale episode will be on February 25th. It will include some old friends and some surprise guests, so put it on your calendars. Our producer is Casey O'Brien. Our senior producer is Laura Swisher, and this has been a production of MaximumFun.org.
A woman. That should be really interesting.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Audience supported.